Our next speakers are going to be Alan Rudzinski, mathematician at NIST, and Apostol Vasiliev, who is the cybersecurity expert at NIST. If we can just get their slides set up really quickly.
How do I get the slides and how do I move from one to another?
Yeah. I hope they already got loaded on here. Whoops, I just filled that. Do you know what yours were? Oh, sorry.
Then up and down, page down, right?
That should work. Yes.
And this will not be visible, right?
No, you're just, yeah, all they can see is that screen.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but it should have been more dramatic.
Are you going to
All right. Thanks, everyone. If we could sit down and get started with this so that we don't run any further behind. We've got here Alan Rudzinski, mathematician at NIST, giving a presentation on the algorithm transitions and related implementation guidances as laid out in Special Pub 800-131A and, of course, the IG documents. Alan.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, everyone, and good afternoon. I work in the CMVP group at NIST, and part of our job, actually most of our job, is to validate different cryptographic modules used by the U.S. government, or at least prepared to be used by the U.S. government. The same modules are used throughout the industry and throughout the world. As part of this work, we have a general standard that governs this validation. That's FIPS 140-2. That is a relatively stable standard. It hasn't changed much in the last 13 years. However, the standard relies on the algorithms that do change, and they're part of the standard. They're listed in the annexes. The algorithms change because the industry changes, the computing environment changes, and in particular, the strength of the cryptographic protection may not be sufficient today as it was 10 or even 3 years ago. That's why my group, together with another group at NIST called the Cryptographic Technology Group, we look all the time at the strength of various algorithms and at the strength of various keys in the algorithms, because an algorithm may work perfectly well, but the key is not strong enough, not long enough, so it can be exhausted. As you probably all know, happened with DES many years ago. It was a great invention in the 1970s, and then it could be broken in 3 days, and then it could be broken in 3 hours, and then it could be broken in milliseconds or something like this, in seconds. So DES went away, and after that, some other algorithms became suspicious. So we, long time ago, in 2010, actually started working on a standard that would show how to transition. Even before that, there was a standard in 2005 called SP800-57 that outlined the futuristic view of how it will work and with the good projections of what will be obsolete or will have to be obsolete at a certain time in the future. But it wasn't something for today, for that day. In 2010, we worked on a standard, 131A, which the name is here, and published it in early 2011. I will go over the implications of this standard, because the implications were effective, some of them in 2010, some of them in 2013, and that's already a done deal, and NIST never deviated from the plan. Whatever was planned, we strictly enforced. So now it's the 2015 transition, which I will mostly talk about, and its implications on vendors, testers and users, and then announce, if you will, of course, it's already published by NIST, but announce the next transition phase, the 2017 transition. In addition, we will talk about the NIST plans for the existing validated modules that may or may not survive this transition. So let's go to the next more detailed analysis, more detailed description of what I said. There was this standard 131A, and the original was published in 2011. That's the transition standard. What we have now that we published for comments just a few weeks ago is the revised version, but the core standard was published in 2011. The FIPS 186-4, I want to mention separately because it's a signature standard, a digital signature standard, which also transitions from one version to another. And they are unrelated in one way because one just describes a particular technology, another describes the strength of the algorithms. However, they transition at the same time, more or less, and it's good to mention the transition related to the digital signatures. What most of this transition is about is using the 112-bit cryptography. It was realized early in the century that the 80-bit cryptography that NIST accepted at that time was not going to last very long as a sufficient protection, and the 112-bit cryptography would be necessary. There were already the tools to use it. It wasn't mandatory. We decided to make it mandatory, and announced the transition that slowly showed the path to it. Now we're at the tail end of this transition. Major change is coming in 2015. And let's go and take a look at what it is. So 80 bits is not good. This is not good. SHA-1. SHA-1 is a hash function, which, depending upon its use, may result in either 80 bits or 160 bits of strength. If used in digital signatures, there is a collision property of hash functions that comes into play that weakens its effective strength from 160-bit output to 80 bits. And that became unacceptable before it was. So we had to be very careful with SHA-1 because it was used in many industry protocols. Yet it was not strong enough. What do you do? Then there are some algorithms, like the random number generators, that regardless of a key strength, were not strong enough. The problem with them is this, that the random number generator is only as good as the amount of uncertainty fed into it. The model that NIST uses is this. You first start with the entropy source, and then you use it to feed it into a deterministic random number generator that doesn't generate more uncertainty, but changes the bits and reproduces the string of outputs that looks very much indistinguishable from the truly random source. So for any observer who doesn't know the entropy source, the deterministic random number generator is just as good as the entropy source. But if you know the entropy source, it's not good. So this is talking about the deterministic random number generator. The older ones that are not in SP800-90A, they do not have a built-in mechanism to provide for new entropy. Now, it doesn't mean that you cannot feed the new entropy into them, but there is no mechanism. You have to basically understand how to do it. The newer random number generators, those that are documented in SP800-90A, they do have this mechanism. There is no guarantee that the mechanism is used properly, but it is there. That is why this transition moves from the older RNGs to newer RNGs. And that transition, we will talk about it more in greater detail, and actually it's a big part of this talk. But that is the 2015 transition. So here is, just to keep up with the notation that was used since 2011 when we published the first version of SP 800-131A, the change, the names that we assigned to different status of the algorithms. The green ones are okay. What's the difference between approved and acceptable? Approved means that it's been published by NIST as an algorithm that NIST recommends. It's NIST recommended, and therefore it's approved. The problem is that since it was published, it might have happened that the strength would become insufficient, or at least the strength of some of the keys allowed with this algorithm would be insufficient. So for the purpose of the transition, if it's also acceptable, then not only it's approved, but you can use it without any further concerns. NIST fully stands by this algorithm. As an example, the digital signature algorithms that produce the 80 bits of strength are approved because they're in the digital signature standard published by NIST. But because of the transition, they are not acceptable. In the same document, we have 112-bit strong digital signatures. They are acceptable. Deprecated. Deprecated means that you can use it. It's legal to use it even within the federal domain to protect sensitive data. But NIST doesn't stand by the security security of the algorithm, or it doesn't recommend it and stands only for the security that we advertise. It doesn't stand for the security that we require. So an example of the reason that an algorithm can be deprecated, it's either it's non-compliant with some of the standards, so it's not approved, but it has a sufficient key strength, and we allow it simply because the industry insists on it. Sometimes you have to do it and allow the industry to keep it for a while, but we cannot guarantee that it's good, so we call it deprecated. Another reason is that the key sizes may not be sufficient, and we still allow them, but they're not sufficient. That's why we do not stand by its security. Restricted, which the category that will only live another 2 months. It's really deprecated, but there are some additional conditions. So it's deprecated, but in one case, and in one case only, for the triple death algorithm, not only NIST doesn't stand by it in general at this time, it allows it, but it allows it only with an additional condition. So it's a lower level of deprecation, and because this particular transition will get completed at the end of this year, this category will go away. Legacy use, you can use it, but when? For example, let's say something was encrypted, and now you cannot encrypt it this way because the key is not strong enough. So this encryption algorithm is not approved, not acceptable. However, if something is encrypted and it's important, don't you want at least to be able to decrypt it, and if it comes to it? What if it's some critical message encrypted by some bad players in the game, by some parties that you want to know what they encrypted? If you couldn't even decrypt it, they would be very happy, use these algorithms, maybe a little weaker than what NIST requires, but 5 years ago they were not weaker, and we would not be legally allowed to decrypt it or to verify their signatures. So for these purposes, we allow the old algorithms mostly for the decryption and for the signature verification. It's just a necessity because they existed at some time. And finally, in red, it's disallowed. You cannot use it, not even for any purpose, not as deprecated, not for legacy use. It's disallowed. And the more we go further into as the time goes by, the more algorithms become disallowed. Of course, NIST introduces the new algorithms that become approved. And it's like everything in life, you know, some things die and new things are born. And hopefully it all makes sense when you look at the individual algorithms. So before I move into the individual algorithms, any questions so far? If it's not approved, not acceptable, not deprecated, not restricted, disallowed. And all of this in the context of the federal use. Of course, if you private business, you can do whatever you want, and nobody will tell you what is allowed, what is not. But for the purposes of the US federal users and those who want to imitate the federal standards, it's disallowed if it's not one of these.
So let me rephrase it. Can I have a module that is 240 validated and that includes some algorithm that are disallowed?
The FIPS 140-2 validated modules are allowed to operate either in approved mode or a non-approved mode.
So that is
right. Everything that we say is in the approved mode. The non-approved mode, NIST has no, except that NIST asks or requires the vendors to document many properties of this, of the operation in the non-approved mode. There is no particular cryptographic or security requirement. If you want to do something really weak and expose your keys in the non-approved mode, we don't have a mandate to stop you. Yes, please.
I just want to make sure I understand the approved. So approved means that at one time it was a NIST approved algorithm, you had a standard for it, but it could be deprecated, it could be restricted, it could be disallowed, it could be in legacy use, and it may be unacceptable. Is that true?
This is very close to how I would anyway describe it. Approved means that it's listed in the current NIST recommendations. There are many NIST recommendations. Now, then we published 131A, which affected many, if not all, of these NIST recommendations. We didn't want to basically throw away all of these recommendations. Some parts of this, some versions of the algorithm, even though they're still approved because the definition they're recommended by NIST, they did not pass the transition requirement. So if that's the case, they were either acceptable if they do pass those requirements, or they, well, either deprecated or restricted or something else based on the details of 131A. The alternative would be to rework all of the standards at the time 131A was published. It's easier to say in 131A what is still approved and what is not. All right. This is about the individual algorithms, the encryption algorithms. The only transition in 2010 was the retirement of the skipjack encryption, which was not a popular algorithm in the first place. There are less than 10 validated versions of this algorithm and wasn't heavily used. It was approved, however. So it became the encryption, it became legacy use only, and so was the decryption. Basically, you don't use it. Then, another important algorithm is the triple DES. The triple DES has two versions, or two ways to set up a key. A three-key triple DES when each of the three keys is independently generated, and the two key, when you have one key, then another, then first key. As you can guess, and the research demonstrated, the two-key version is not as strong as the three-key versions. There are attacks, not easy attacks to master, but there are attacks. And it was determined that the attacks bring the strength to this expression, the minimum of 112 and 120 minus 9, minus n bits, when you have 2 to the power of n plain text, cipher text pairs encrypted under the same key and available to the attacker. That's when the best attack works, with this assumption. It's a paper published long time ago in the 1990s, and it was a good indication that there was no follow-up paper because nobody was able, at least publicly, to improve on this attack, which means that it's probably hard to improve. But it is there, the attack. So we had to deal with it. Our target is 112. So if n is greater than 8, more than 256 pairs, you weaken your strength beyond the 112-bit minimum. So through 2015, NIST decided to allow at most 2 to the power of 20 encryptions to be performed with the same key, using two-key triple deaths. That's what made this algorithm restricted. Not only it was deprecated already, but that's the restriction. And if you plug the number 20 from 220 into this little formula, you will get the minimum of 112 and 100, right? 120 minus 20 is 100. So the answer is it's 100, the minimum. And the question is, how does it work together with the NIST announcement that now there is only 112-bit encryption? And the answer is that was the only exception that NIST in 131A allowed. Yes, it's 100 bits. It's only was going to live through 2015 when the rest of the transition to 112 took place at the end of 2013, two more years. And it's still 100, it's not that bad. It's beyond the brute force attack capability of the people believe of the modern computers. And it's only two more years, but it's going away. It's going away in less than 2 months. And we see among our vendors that they move away from triple deaths, from the two-key triple deaths, and in general from the triple deaths to the AES. But so this actual announcement worked as intended. It was a smooth transition. Not every time there was a smooth transition, but this provided the proper warning. The new technology, the alternative technology, was available, and the vendors took the notice and stopped enlarge using this transition. We explained in 131A exactly why this is the strength and why the transition. So that's going to be gone at the end of this year, and no other encryption algorithm transitions are expected.
So I have a question. If I have a level three, say I have a level three module that supports two-key triple des, it has a FIPS mode indicator, and right now it supports two-key triple des, and it says, oh, everything's fine and dandy, I'm using two-key triple des. In 2016, is my FIPS mode indicator now broken, and do I need to patch this?
It's an excellent question, which there were lots of discussions at NIST. I can give you the answer quickly because there were many heated arguments over this particular issue, which is, it's a very good insight. Yes, you can change everything, but what if you build your module in certain way when this was allowed in FIPS mode and now it's not, and the indicator tells you when it's in FIPS mode or in approved mode? What do you do? For this particular case, when the module was validated at the time the particular technology was acceptable, and that's the same module, you don't have to change this indicator. It's a disservice to the user, I agree. The user doesn't know if you really switched in this particular case. But at the same time, it would be too harsh on the vendors of those. They did everything right. They built it, everything. They might have changed the documentation to show what it is, but they cannot change this indicator. But every module validated after 2013 in case of 112 bits in general, and after 2015 for this particular transition, the new modules will not, the teller will not be validated if the FIPS mode correspond indicator is not correct. Now, it's only level 3 and level 4, because at the lower level, you don't have this indicator. Great question. I want to make sure that you know that the answer is it will be tolerated. I feel, again, for the users who may not get the full entropy of the information from... Because our guidance says that the three subs revalidations have to be compliant with the standard at the time of the submission of the revalidation. So it will affect the three subs as well. All right. The digital signature. Here, there are no exceptions of any kind. Less than 112 bits of encryption strength disallowed as of the end of 2013. So by now, it's largely accepted, and all the new modules for the last 2 years or so follow it. We received an enormous number of submissions in late December of 2013 when it was still legal not to use it. Why anybody would submit a module for validation when in a few days it would not be allowed to use in FIPS mode. I cannot comment on that, but we validate what we have at the rule that exists at the time. Right now, if there is a new module, of course, we will not validate it. If in FIPS mode, it has less than 112 bits of strength when performing the digital signatures. Again, verifying the signatures, and it's made very clear, in 131A. Verifying, you can use lower strength because we don't want some old contract to sit there for years and be signed when it was still legal to sign it and not be able to verify it now. Of course not, but the new contracts or whatever is signed have to be signed with the strong keys. And it's not only the strong keys, but the better standard, 186-4. It explains how to generate keys, and in accordance, the CMVP started requiring the testing of the generation of the keys after 2015. It also shows the details of the elliptic curve and the RSA signatures that were before mostly referenced to the other standards, but now they're largely contained in the NIST standard, and we on top of it. The standard has some informative appendices that explain why something is done the way it's done and why it results in such and such strength. So it's a self-contained standard, and it's a tremendous improvement from the previous version. In my opinion, it's a big improvement, both in terms of the key strength and in terms of the way it shows how to generate signature and justifies the security. So it interprets it. There is an exception, industry-driven exception. As I mentioned earlier, SHA-1, when used in signature generation, only delivers 80 bits of strength, or at least can be guaranteed to deliver only 80 bits. But in the TLS and the SSH protocols that are used worldwide, they use SHA-1. And then what do? You have to communicate with those people, with the people who use this. It's not something that is totally hidden inside your module, that if you change, it doesn't affect directly the others. Maybe your module will work better, but the others will not be affected. This will affect the people. And that is why NIST published another standard, SP800-52, to cover a TLS, the use of TLS, and specifically allowed the use of the SHA-1 in the RSA digital signature only in these protocols. And the key strength still has to be 112 bits. It doesn't affect this allowance, doesn't affect the key strength, but it affects the hash function. SHA-1 is okay until hopefully the industry changes and starts using multiple SHA functions, or not necessarily SHA, but anyway, hash functions that is approved. This is the biggest one of all, and the letters are not big enough to really deliver the message. We, in our group, we're trying to spread this message for 4 or 5 years already, and I want to use this opportunity to do it again. At the end of this year, all of the random number generators that are not compliant with one of the three generators in the NIST publication SP800-98 will be disallowed retroactively. It's up to the user basically to analyze the risk and decide what they're going to do, but the NIST position is here. And of course, the federal users will not be able to acquire new equipment if it relies on the use of these RNGs in the approved mode. The good part is that it only affects the module itself. The partners don't know which RNG you're using. The greater impact is that it affects a very large number of modules. And I would like to stop here and announce something that is not part of my slides because it wasn't even negotiated at the time the slides were submitted to the conference. But there are decisions that NIST made, or the CMVP made, with respect to the modules that use those non-compliant RNGs. Basically, the question is how to handle it. Okay, this allowed, then what? How do you administer this change in what is allowed and what is not? And so I will talk about it for a couple of minutes and also about some other list of disallowed modules. There are four categories of modules, right? Those that don't use any random number generators. No SP890A, no old ones, just nothing. It's not part of it. Nothing changes, right? The module is still good. Then there are modules that only use the so-called DRBGs, those are 90A RBGs. Again, no problem. They were allowed, they're still allowed, there is absolutely no problem. The problem is with the other two categories that use the RNGs. The RNGs are the pre-90A random number generators. The module can only use an RNG, or it can have both, the new and the old generator that's both a pre-90A and a 90A compliant RNG. So the last two categories are in question. How do you evaluate what the module can and cannot do now? Because the random numbers are used everywhere in signature generation, in key generation, when generating the IVs, nonsense. It's very difficult to answer this question and to properly reposition the algorithms as approved or allowed, and those working in FIPS mode or not. But it has to be done. So, and what NIST decided to do, what the CMVP decided to do, is to put all of those modules that use RNG in any the pre-90A RNGs in any capacity into the so-called legacy list, effective the beginning of next year. Legacy list, again, that means that the government buyers cannot acquire them, at least that's our understanding of, at least that's our understanding of how FISMA should be interpreted with regard to this legacy list. And until and unless a further action is taken by vendors, they will remain in the legacy list and could not be used. If the particular vendor wants to insist or wants to reuse this module, want to again start selling this module, they can take a look at the module's design and say, look, this portion doesn't use the RNG. This one can be somehow handled differently. Anyway, it's going to be a new validation, probably a difficult case because originally the module was this 10 minutes, all right. So they will have to do the job, not us. We will just validate it, and the testing laboratories will test it. But the burden of proof is with the vendors if they want to take it. Maybe they don't want to. Maybe they're very happy to move on to the newer modules, and that's perfectly fine with us. But if they want to do something, they have to do it. And the second list will be for the older, so-called older modules. At the end of 2016, we plan to retire, in the sense of putting them in another legacy list, all of the modules that were last validated in 2011 and before. Which means that if there was any kind of revalidation, we will keep it. Because that means that the vendor is on top of it, they know what they're doing, and the laboratory looked at it, okay. It may not be the best technology because the original validation was a long time ago, but somebody keeps looking at it, okay. But if there was no activity from the validation standpoint in the past 5 years, it will be put into legacy use. Yes, please. Right, for the RNG list at the end of this year, mm-hmm. For the timing list at the end of 2016, a year and 2 months from now, the modules that were last validated or revalidated in 2011 or earlier will get downgraded to this legacy list. And then the expectation is that at the end of 2017, those that were validated in 2012 will join them, but that we'll see. So that's a big announcement in addition to the slides. But since my time is running short, I would say this. I think that's another important thing, that another transition is scheduled, or at least is planned, for 2017, which was not in the original version of SP800-131A. The problem is that there are many algorithms that became deprecated because of the needs of the industry. And we understand it. They deprecated, they have strong keys, but they're not compliant with our standards. These are the key establishment algorithms, the key agreement, the key transport, which breaks into the key encapsulation and key wrapping, depending upon what kind of mechanism, what kind of algorithm is used to transport it. And it's a big exposure in our view that, yes, they may have a long key, a good key, but nothing else. Maybe the algorithm is very poor. We simply have no idea what it is. If they call it Diffie-Hellman, we validate it, because that's what our documents say. It's time to stop it, or at least to give it the certain date in the future when this ought to stop. And we are very sensitive to the industry needs and the constraints. You cannot just throw away everything you have. But at the same time, you cannot continue business as usual. So we give more than 2 years. We might update our own standards to become more in compliance, if you will, with the industry standards, which means that some algorithms will be approved because they will be in compliance with our standard. The goal is to always know what kind of algorithm is used in a module. It has to be reviewed, and right now they're not because we don't have a standard for them. So it goes into the detail how it affects the key agreement, how it affects the key transport, and the 38F is a specific case of the key transport called the key wrapping because it's the symmetric key encryption that is used to transport the key. How many minutes?
5 minutes.
Okay. So that's what it is. In 2017, you will have to do it. And like I feel the time pressure, I'm sure you will, and the larger community at large will feel the time pressure when the end of 2017 come close. But at some point it has to be done. And the more we talk about it, I think the better service we provide to the crypto community. Yes, please.
So, because I don't have all these memorized, after 2017, can I use TLS, SSH, Diffie-Hellman?
As it stands now, after 2017, you can only use the algorithms that are compliant with 56A. Now, I understand you asked a different question. But that is the answer I can give you because we will have to work out what 56A will look like and what the TLS will look like at that time. What I can tell you that at that time they will have to comply with each other. Now, who will change and to what extent, that remains to be seen. And believe me, we work, my group, very closely with the group at NIST that is working on the individual standard so that They understand the problem themselves, but we work with them also to be sure that the pain is minimized. But if there is a protocol that that group doesn't accept into its domain by 2017, then yes, no, you cannot use it. Yes, please.
Question, and it has to deal with, you talked about four scenarios with regard to random number generators. If you had a case where you supported both the RNG and the DRBG.
Yeah.
So assuming that you supported both, are you okay then? There's nothing for you to do as to maintain your validation? Because obviously if one has become legacy and not legacy RNG, you can default to the other one? Or do we have to resubmit a security policy to say that the old random number generator is no longer valid? Is there a process involved with that?
Right. This is one of the two categories of the four where the module will be moved into the legacy list and the vendor will have to review it. So in this particular case, they will have to see how it all works. If it is a cryptographic library, let's say, that receives calls from an application that may require only an output from a DRBG, from a 98 random bit generator, or from the old one, it will be relatively easy to redefine some services as approved and some non-approved, and probably revalidate the module. However, in some cases, it's core to the operation of the module, even if it has the DRBG, that it also has an old RNG, and the module cannot operate, or many of the module's other algorithms cannot operate without accepting the input from this RNG. Then it is a much more difficult task for the vendor to either redesign it or change the algorithms from the approved to the non-approved.
So I'm wondering, is this a documentation exercise that we would need to resubmit a security policy to say that this random number generator is no longer valid, or do we just leave things as they are and with the assumption that assuming that you're using a DRBG, you're in FIPS mode, if you're using an RNG, you're not in FIPS mode?
It is an exercise in reanalyzing the module. As a result of your analysis, you can see that you can solve the problem by changing the documentation, and that is reassigning some services as from the approved category into the non-approved. Let's say using an RNG output is used to be approved, now it's non-approved, and that's it. Could be, and there are modules like this. But your analysis may show that it's not that simple, that there is the output of the RNG is core to the operation and nothing else works. Then It's not a documentation exercise. It's an exercise in reanalysis, and then what you resubmit has to be compliant with our standards at that time. And that's all. You just basically resubmit it, and we will look at it with the current architecture and standards in mind. You're exactly right. That category, as long as the RNG is implemented, whether it also implements the new one, it goes into this legacy list. These are the two categories that go. And thank you for rewording it. That's exactly what I wanted to say. The burden is on the vendor and on the lab that will present the vendor's solution to the CMVP. And what it will take probably will be different answers for different modules.
Thank you very much, Alan.